All right. Welcome, everybody. Tonight's topic is the Kabbalah industry. So what we're going to do is talk a little bit about what Kabbalah is, and then also a little bit about what Kabbalah might not be. Tell you where the motivation...
One second.
All right. And we're still live. Okay. So the impetus for this class came from a lot of discussions with individuals who have realized that Kabbalah is a term that's thrown out a lot. Something been made very popular by a few very big stars in Hollywood. And people often wonder what it is that Kabbalah is and why is it that it's so accessible to so many people. So what I want to do tonight is just give you a sense of what Kabbalah is from my own perspective. What I've done is I've tried to provide you with a lot of sources so that you have a sense of how it is that Kabbalah was traditionally viewed. And then we can talk about where it's gone from there. Okay? Okay. So, I believe there are more source sheets on their way in. They'll probably be in a minute or two. I'll tell you a few personal anecdotes that I've experienced in my own lifetime. I'm from a city called Toronto, in a great country called Canada. And Toronto has a Kabbalah center. And it was set up many years ago. And I have a cousin that became very involved in the Kabbalah center. And she was somebody who was sort of nominally involved in Judaism, didn't really have a formal Jewish education of any sort, but found herself attracted to the ideas of what were being presented as Kabbalah. And so she decided to start getting involved. And at a certain point, she ended up really dedicating her entire life to this center. She gave away all of her assets to the center. She had very little to do with anyone else in our family after a certain point. And she really went down a path that we didn't really necessarily recognize. She ended up being introduced to a spouse, also from the Kabbalah Center. They got married in a very short period of time. And after not very long, it ended in a very terrible divorce, and she was left sort of in complete poverty with absolutely nothing to her name. I have another friend that is a Jewish educator who told me that she went on a retreat once, a Kabbalah retreat, and she's somebody that had a tremendous background in Tanakh. She is a Tanakh teacher. She teaches it in all sorts of different venues in Toronto. And she said that when she arrived at this retreat and she started asking questions, immediately she was isolated and she felt like she couldn't really participate in anything else. And people said to her, she knows too much and it makes her a little bit dangerous and she's given off very negative vibes that are affecting everybody else. So it was something that sort of, you know, concerns me, my family, you know, other people around. So I decided to do some of my own investigation. I then left Toronto. I went to Israel to study for 8.5 years in various yeshivot. And I didn't really think much about the issue until I was back in the Bay Area and people started asking me all sorts of questions. And so what I want to do, like I said, is introduce you to a perspective on what is Kabbalah and then take you from there to who it is that studies Kabbalah from a traditional perspective, and some of what Kabbalah is not. So to begin, I think the easiest definition of Kabbalah is that Kabbalah is sort of a science and a systematic attempt to try to understand as much as we can about God and creation and the way that He sustains and directs His creation. That's what Kabbalah is about. So when people describe Torah, Torah usually is understood as the instruction book. The word for Torah, the Hebrew word, actually has the same root as hora'ah, which means instructions. Parents in Hebrew are horim, and teachers are morim. Right? You have a more or a morah, depending on masculine or feminine, and it's all the same root. It has to do with instruction. So the Torah, as we understand it, generally tries to teach us about how we are supposed to live our lives. The written books of the Torah contain within them 613 commandments that are supposed to direct us, and then what's known as the oral Torah, colloquially, is sort of the explanation of how all of those apply with all of their various parameters. Kabbalah is understood as something that isn't necessarily there to instruct us with laws and regulations per se of how to live our lives, but to give us a much deeper understanding as to how God runs the world, the nature of God unto itself, as much as we can fathom that as human beings. And it's a discipline that was also given to Moses at Sinai. Much of what exists in Kabbalah is discussed as a metaphor. It's very difficult to pick up some of the main works that were written many years ago, like the Zohar, for example, that's understood as sort of the main text in Kabbalah, and to just read it straight. A lot of what's there is written metaphorically. It's not written to be understood necessarily by lay people. And the traditional approach to studying Kabbalah was that somebody needed a master or a guide to walk them through and explain all the metaphors and unpackage it so that one could be able to relate to it and understand what it means. So what I'd like to do is start with the first source that you have in front of you. Hopefully everybody has a copy. You can let me know if you don't. Or at least you have someone you can share with. Okay. So this first source, and they're stapled as if they are to follow the Hebrew. Okay, so the stapled in the top right. So just follow with me. So this is from the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. People here familiar with the Ramchal at all? He was a 17th century scholar in Italy, and he wrote some very, very famous works. The Path of the Just is one of his works that's considered very famous. Right, The Way of God. There's all sorts of things. Sorry, what was that?
Take a pen over there.
Take a pen?
Yeah.
These are pencils. There you go.
Okay.
And he wrote extensive works that dealt with issues in Kabbalah and dealt with Kabbalah itself. In fact, it's fascinating. I noticed that we don't have a set of the Ramchal here in this room, but there's a green set that was printed many years ago, and the way that they actually order it is they use stars. And so it goes in ascending order by number of stars. And you're supposed to accomplish each book before you try and attempt the next one. And he deals with all sorts of mystical concepts. In his time, he was actually persecuted. He had to run away from Italy, and he escaped to Israel eventually. But he died at a very young age. He was only 40 years old when he passed away. So his entire compendium of work was written when he was very young. And his description of Kabbalah is, the entire wisdom of the Kabbalah is only to understand how the supreme will governs, for what purpose he created all these different creatures, what he wants from them, and what will come at the end of all the cycles of the universe, and how these strange cycles are to be explained. Everyone got that? It's a mouthful. So he continues, he says, for the supreme will himself already calculated the entire cycle of governance, ending with complete perfection. These calculations and measures are what we are explaining when we speak about the spherot and the worlds. In other words, a lot of what we understand as Kabbalah is material dealing with things that are up there, and it's a wisdom that allows us to understand how the supreme will, i.e. God, really governs everything that exists in creation and where he's trying to take it. Another explanation for how we understand Kabbalah is from the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon lived over 200 years ago in Vilna. He was regarded, actually, he was celebrated as a national figure in Lithuania even recently. There was a commemoration at the 200th anniversary of his death. And he is understood to be one of the, I guess, leading sages of his generation in the non-Hasidic camp. And we'll explain a little bit further as to why that becomes significant. So the Vilna Gaon, in his commentary to the book of Mishlei, which is Proverbs, says the following. The Torah has two general levels of meaning. One is pshat, or the simple meaning, and the other is sod, or the secrets that are lurking beneath the surface. So the pshat also includes a sub-level, which is known as drash, wherein one delves into the meaning and broadens the halacha. So very often you'll hear people talk about making a drash. What they're doing is they're actually taking the text as their basis, and they're using the text as a springboard to then expound on it, often in a halachic context, but not always. And it says it sort of includes a sub-level, which is remez. Remez means a hint, right, or an insinuation. So this includes various forms of codes or other indications that there is indeed something beneath the surface. Remez is thus the gateway to sod. Right? So the understanding of remez is, remez are hints that will lead to sod, which are the secrets that are in there.
Is it okay to ask questions,
sir? Sure.
So about Ramchal, I just want to go back a little bit. You said he passed away at 40, and maybe it was after him that the rabbis decided that he shouldn't study Kabbalah until after 40?
Okay, good question. Right, good question. So he was someone who made an exception for himself, and his teachers made an exception for him. The idea of 40 is not necessarily a steadfast, hard rule, but the idea is that 40, there's an expression that one reaches the age of 40, they attain wisdom. Right? That a person has to have enough life experience to really be able to understand what it is that's involved in Kabbalah, and also to interpret a lot of the metaphors. So the convention has become that people should be 40 years old before they start studying. He was a child prodigy, and he knew all of the Torah and the entire Talmud and all the Midrashim and everything that existed before he even ventured into Kabbalah. Okay? All right. So now, according to the Vilna Gaon, the description also of Kabbalah is it's your access point to the secrets and this deeper dimension that exists within Torah. So then we see another source from the Datsfuno. So this is again from the Ramchal. It's from a different work. And he says the following. It says, the discipline of Kabbalah was given... Actually, so this might be actually Rav Chaim Friedlander, who was a mashgiach. He was a supervisor in a yeshiva in Bnei Brak. And he says, the discipline of Kabbalah was given at Sinai as one of the levels of interpretation of the Torah. It was passed on from one generation to the next. Immediately following the destruction of the Second Temple, at the beginning of the Dark Exile, which we are presently in, Shimon Bar Yochai received divine inspiration, which enabled him to create a systematic exposition of the concepts of Kabbalah. Okay, so that's an important point. That before Shimon Bar Yochai, everything was passed down orally, and it wasn't taught in public, and we'll see that later on. It says his teachings were composed by his disciples into the book of the Zohar. However, even after this was committed to writing, only a select few people in each generation had access to it. It was not publicized to the masses. Even after it was revealed some 600 years ago, it still remained a closed book to all but the most spiritually refined people. About 400 years ago, God sent the Jewish people an exceedingly great man named Rav Yitzchak Luria, known as the Ari or the Arizal. And this man was considered, or is considered until today, the chief expositor of the Zohar, and his teachings expose the depth and breadth of this discipline in all its detail. So about 3 centuries ago.
Is this the one that has the synagogue in Tzfat?
Yeah. That's the Ari synagogue. That's right. So what we find again is that Kabbalah was a discipline. It existed. It existed in written form from a couple thousand years ago. And even when it was committed to writing, it was not put into writing so that it could become accessible to everybody. But rather, it was there as a tool to aid people who were privy to be able to learn the discipline. So who is able to learn the discipline? Again, people who have accomplished as much study as they felt they could possibly cover when it comes to the Torah and the Talmud and other works. One of the ideas of the Talmud is the Talmud gives people a framework of understanding how to relate to everything that exists within the world as we understand it. And so it has the effect that it really it gives a discipline to one's life where people understand how to interact with everything. From the very, very mundane, like food, and what is kosher, what is not kosher, how it should be prepared, etc., to things that one would consider to be a little bit more lofty, like sacrifices that used to exist, The Talmud really has commentary on a lot of what's in the written Torah, and much more than that. Aside from just the halachic element of the Talmud, what we also have is what's known as the agadic element, which means that there are stories that are told, there's history, there's culture that was transmitted. If you think about the Talmud, I guess the best metaphor that one could use to describe it is it's almost like a time capsule. That the sages of the era decided that they wanted to try to encapsulate and protect and retain everything about what Jewish life was like. And so if you go through the entire Talmud, what you find is everything from recipes to medical advice to history and then to what we would call straight halacha. But it's that expansive. So it's understood that learning the Talmud is supposed to be a prerequisite for getting into the study of what's beyond that, which is known as Kabbalah. As I just tell you another personal anecdote. When I was in Israel studying in yeshiva, I had not mastered the entire Talmud by any stretch. But my wife and I thought it would be nice to go and get a bracha, a blessing, from a great rabbi. So we went in to visit someone who was, you know, Rabbi Kaduri. I don't know if you're familiar with that name, but he was the chief Sephardic rabbi. And we went in to see him and to try to get a bracha from him, which we did. And on the way out, there were a bunch of gentlemen that were passing by going in. And they were sort of rushing. And I heard one of them say to the other, Mincha's starting. So, oh, not Mincha, sorry, Maariv, the evening prayer. So I turned to my wife and I said, oh, this is perfect. This is convenient. I need to pray myself. So I turned around, I started walking with them, and one of them turned around and he put his hand in and he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to daven with you. So he said, no, you can't come. So I said, what do you mean? I'm also Jewish, right? Why can't I daven with you? And he said, no, you can't go in there. So I said, why not? So he said, because the people in that minyan know all the kavanot. What does that mean? They know exactly what to concentrate on at every word in the prayer, at every time, and you have to be able to do that to be able to participate in that minyan. And I said, all right. And I left. Luckily, I was in Jerusalem, so I could catch a minyan until 3 in the morning. Right? That's easy over there. But it was the first time that I'd ever heard of that idea. But there is such an idea that people who have studied this and really, really have a good sense of it, the way they approach everything, especially prayer and talking to God, is just very different. They know exactly what to think about with every single word, almost every single letter that they encounter. I should also mention there was a big tragedy this past week in Israel. I don't know if everybody saw the news. But one of the top Kabbalists in the world was actually murdered in a mind-boggling circumstance. Abu Chatzera from Be'er Sheva had somebody who came in to visit him and asked for a blessing. And when the person was alone with this rav, he took out a knife and he stabbed him. And it's something that I've never heard of anything similar. But I just figured it's worth mentioning. Maybe part of this class can act as an healing nishmat, that it can maybe be something meritorious for him now that he's no longer with us. Okay, so what I want to do now is take you to source number 4, the Mishnah in Chagiga. So it says in the Mishnah, do not expound on Maisa Bereshit. Maisa Bereshit literally means the act of creation, to two students, or on Maisa Merkava, even to one student, unless he's a wise person who is able to intuit the concepts on his own. So what does that mean? So this is an instruction to a teacher or rabbi that one should not teach about creation in public. And the definition of public is two students at one time. Why not? Because you have to make sure that everything that's being conveyed about creation is being properly understood, and it's hard to do that with two students. Today, we talk about differentiated education instruction, right? But the idea is that if you have someone one-on-one, you can really make sure they really understand. And then it goes further and it says, when it comes to what's known as the Maisa Merkava, which literally means the chariot and the act of the chariot of God. So that you shouldn't do even to one student, unless they are a wise person who can intuit the concepts on his own. So Maaseh Merkava usually refers to things that have to do with understanding the way that God really interacts with the world. The chariot is sort of this vehicle for God, whatever that means. So to explain it, I'm going to look at source number 5 on the Me'iri, right, from the Me'iri, who says that Maaseh Bereishit includes the wisdom of the physical world, like astronomy and cosmology, while Maaseh Merkava involves metaphysical phenomena, like the world of angels, the understanding of God's existence, and his unique oneness. The true understanding of the concepts of Maaseh Merkava are above human comprehension. Even angels can't understand spiritual levels of worlds above them. Still, through the study of Maaseh Merkava, one can attain a certain knowledge of these things according to his personal capabilities. So what the Me'iri explains as an explanation of that Mishnah is that the reason that you're not supposed to just teach it to anybody, even if you're by yourself, is because it's something that's beyond our comprehension. So then why are you teaching it at all? Because even though ultimately it's beyond us, if we strive to understand it, there are parts of it that can have a positive impact. But again, the Mishnah says, only to somebody who is wise enough, who can understand things or intuit things on their own. In Judaism, there is a concept of having different types of intelligences. So, in fact, Chabad, people are familiar with the term Chabad? Right? I don't know if everyone knows it. Chabad is actually an acronym for Chochma, Bina, and Da'at. So Chochma refers to knowledge that one amasses from an external source. So if you read a book, you're acquiring Chochma. If you hear a lecture, that could be Chochma that you're acquiring. Bina, which is the second type, is more of an analytical understanding of being able to take information that you already have in your head and start to extrapolate and reapply it to other circumstances. That's what Bina is. And Da'at is the capacity to take what you have in your head and apply it to other people. In other words, connect it to other people or connect it to yourself so intrinsically that you end up living your life according to that knowledge and that information. You know, in our world we see it all the time. There are people that can write treatises on how important it is to be charitable, but it doesn't necessarily translate to how they conduct their daily affairs. Da'at is the capacity to take what it is that you know and make sure that it really becomes internalized so that you are affected by it and you then live your life according to it. So what's interesting is that the expression that's used here in the Mishnah is that someone has to be a chacham umevin, which means he has to have that wisdom that he's acquired from elsewhere. Mevin means that he has that capacity of bina to be able to extrapolate something from something else and apply it to new circumstances. Midaato, which means from his da'at, from that center point of understanding from which he, everything else will ultimately emanate and he will be able to function. So one thing that's important to point out is that Kabbalah, the name Kabbalah itself, refers to receiving. In Hebrew, lekabel means to receive something. So Kabbalah means that which was received. By implication, it's something a person cannot discover on their own. It has to be something that was received, and you have to receive it from somebody that obviously has it. So what we find is that Rav Moshe Cordovero, who is also regarded as one of the leading Kabbalists of the 17th century, he writes in Pardes Rimon, says, really it was a question and rather he by that had been asked to one of the preeminent sages in the 10th century by the name of Rabbi Hai Gaon, which sort of shows that Rabbi Hai Gaon himself was involved in Kabbalah study. There was a question that was asked to him, which was, please enlighten us, our master. On the one hand, our sages discussed the 13 attributes of God that were revealed to Moses. On the other hand, in the book that's ascribed to our patriarch Abraham, which is known as Sefer Yetzirah, we find the concept of the 10 Sefirot. Are these two concepts one and the same? That was the question. I wish I had this asked to me out here. Right? We talk about 13 attributes of God, but then we talk about the 10 spheres of God, which is more of a Kabbalistic concept. So the reply was, the answer to this question is lengthy. Its elaboration would take not a day and not two, for it's bound up in the ropes of the hidden wisdom, that which is concealed in the prophecies and oral transmissions of the wise men. And then Rehai goes on to provide an answer to the question. So, but his introduction indicates that he himself acknowledges that this wisdom does exist. He was privy to it. But that he can't just write a simple answer. Really, someone would have to come and study for more than a number of days in order to understand it, because it's all wrapped up in these great secrets that people shouldn't necessarily have access to.
Which is the book of Abraham?
Sefer Yetzirah. There are some that say that it was actually written by Adam, and then Abraham sort of reproduced it.
What is that?
Sorry, is it? No, it doesn't exist in the Tanakh at all. Right? Something that's separate. Kabbalists have it, use it. It's been printed today. You could buy it. I don't know if there's necessarily a great English translation of it, but it's something that even if one would look at it, it's very hard to understand what it's talking about. And just like everything else in Kabbalah, you would need somebody to really explain what all the metaphors are. Okay.
I thought Shai Gaon was the last Gaon, but then the Vilna is called Vilna Gaon. Why is... Like, I thought Shai Gaon was the last in the Gaonic period.
Okay, good. He was the last in the Gaonic period. The Vilna Gaon did not live in the Gaonic period. The Vilna Gaon lived a couple hundred years ago. The special name Gaon in Hebrew means genius. So the heads of academies were given an honorable title of the geniuses in their era, and that was the era that predated Rashi and the medieval scholars, and they existed mostly in, or I think exclusively, in Babylon. But as we go on in history, certain individuals are, I guess, awarded the title of being a genius, not the same association as belonging to that era. Okay? They say that the Vilna Gaon wrote a math textbook while in the bathroom that was used throughout Lithuania. Just a side hobby. Alright, so he was acknowledged by the Lithuanians as being a genius, not just by the Jewish community. Okay. Alright. Okay, so now, if you look at source number 7, source number 7 comes from the Ramban. Ramban is also known as Nachmanides, and he was sort of the eminent 13th century biblical and Talmudic commentator. So he writes, "I hereby enter the reader into a covenant wherein he undertakes not to philosophize and hypothesize about anything I write that has to do with the secrets of the Torah." What does that mean? And we'll visit him again a little bit later. But what the Ramban does in his commentary is something that is considered to be very unusual. The Ramban, on one hand, has an incredibly pragmatic approach to dealing with things that exist within the Torah text. Very often what he does is he'll take an explanation that Rashi has offered. Rashi is Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, who was a French scholar in the 11th century, who wrote, he was the most prolific of the scholars. Almost every version of the Torah that one finds in Hebrew will have Rashi printed alongside it. So what Rashi does is he actually works almost like a modern hypertext. He associates what's being said in the text as some other source, either the Talmud or one of the Midrashim. But he's selective in what he presents. Nachmanides, who lived after Rashi, in his commentary will often say, Rashi explains it this way, I suggest the following explanation, and he also relies on sources that exist before him. So it's very pragmatic, very practical, and very, very literal very often. And then, all of a sudden, in the Ramban, in Nachmanides' commentary, he just goes off on some kind of a Kabbalistic explanation that is really very, very difficult to understand. And he usually concludes it by saying the Hamevin Yavin, which literally means, and the one who can understand will understand. Usually that's not me. But it's an amazing thing that he does, because he does expose people to what we would regard as Kabbalah within his commentary. But in his introduction, what he says is, I'm making a covenant, a deal with the reader. If you don't understand what I'm saying, don't come up with your own theories. Just leave it, because it doesn't affect you. Just pass over it. Which is really kind of forthright of him to put into his commentary. Okay. So, in history, one of the very famous incidents that had a lot of people buzzing about Kabbalah as a study was the incident of Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was a messianic pretender, and he managed to sway an enormous percentage of the Jewish population to follow him. He met an end whereby he was taken in by the Sultan of Turkey, and he was forced to convert to Islam, which he did. And that sort of ended his path on to be the Messiah. Amazingly enough, he was so convincing that there were actually movements of individuals that continued to follow Shabtai Tzvi for centuries, even after he had become a Muslim. And they had all sorts of explanations as to why and how that might have worked, beyond the scope of this class. But what happened is, as a backlash of Shabtai Tzvi, people started to really frown upon Kabbalists and the Kabbalah as a study that was becoming more popular. Shabtai Tzvi had taken Kabbalistic concepts and used them in order to try to convince people that he was the Messiah, and he developed a tremendous following purely on that basis alone. And so as a result, a lot of the great rabbis in Europe really came out against. And so the persecution of someone like the Ramchal was part of that backlash. There was an attempt to try to make sure that people would not study this or peddle it in such a way that it could be manipulated, and so that people would not be manipulated and convinced to follow something that was false.
When did the Ramchal
live? So the Ramchal was the later 1600s. What we find is that... Sorry.
The Ramchal was persecuted by fellow Jews as opposed to others.
Yes, sorry, by fellow Jews. Persecuted for his teachings. So he escaped the persecution. In other words, he wanted to be able to continue to teach what he was teaching, write his books. But it was a lot of it had to do with his backlash against Kabbalah, in a sense, right? Where a lot of people felt that, how dare you do more of this? We're only going to end up with another Shabtai Tzvi. People are going to take what you're writing, and they're going to use it to their advantage. So there was, to some extent, what people consider to be sort of a suppression of Kabbalah being taught on a mass scale. And that continued until the Hasidic movement of the 18th and 19th centuries, where the Hasidim decided that they would take Kabbalistic concepts and make them more popular. And so we find that a lot of Hasidic groups teach elements of Kabbalah. They don't necessarily teach all of it, but they teach parts that they feel that their adherents should know. And Kabbalah started to gain traction again, and there was more of a discussion of Kabbalah as a study, etc. The Sephardic community also had a much deeper tradition and association with Kabbalah than the Ashkenazic community. So what you'll find to this day very often is that within the Sephardic Siddur, the Zohar will be printed, or parts of the Zohar will be printed, and people will recite parts of the Zohar. Again, many people who recite it don't necessarily know what it's talking about. They recite it because it's understood that it's got to have wisdom in the letters alone, even without a comprehension necessarily. But there are, you know, today, many individuals who certainly have a very deep understanding of what Kabbalah actually is, and it's all rooted in the transmission of a tradition that really goes back century after century after century. Okay. So, now, I just want to turn to source number 8, which is also from the Babylonian Talmud. This is from a tractate known as Chagiga. And it records the following historical observation. It says, four Torah personalities entered the orchard. The word for orchard in Hebrew is pardes. So, pardes is an acronym for pshat, remez, drash, sod. So those were the various levels that we had described earlier. Pshat is a simple understanding of the Torah text. Remez are the hints that lead to the secrets. the Dalid Drash is taking the text and is expanding on it, and so are the secrets that lie within. So it says they are Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, the other.
Is the English word paradise derived from that?
From Pardes?
Yeah.
Paradise?
Garden.
Very possible. Possible. Any good English etymologists? No?
What was the last one then?
So it is secret. So the individuals that enter the Pardes are Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher, which is known as the other, which refers to Elisha ben Abua, who was someone who went astray. In other words, he became an apostate. And Rabbi Akiva. So it says, Ben Azai gazed and died. Ben Zoma gazed and went mad. The other gazed and cut saplings. In other words, he became a heretic. And only Rabbi Akiva emerged complete. So what's this referring to? These four great sages went into this orchard, meaning they enter the study of really getting to the secrets of Kabbalah, and the experience was too powerful for them. The only one that emerged unscathed was Rabbi Akiva. The rest of them all had negative consequences. So that's a story that's recorded in the Talmud almost as a warning that people shouldn't try to pursue the study of things that are beyond them, because God gave us a Torah that we are supposed to work with, and that has to become our first and foremost priority. Just to show you the way that other sages dealt with this. So the Ramak, who is Rav Moshe Cordovero, who we mentioned before, says the following. There are some mistaken people who, although they know neither the scriptures nor the Talmud, nevertheless involve themselves in the study of the discipline, i.e. Kabbalah. So you have to realize that this is going back centuries. So it's not a contemporary phenomenon where we see people who are running to study Kabbalah without having the prerequisite understanding of the Torah. But going back a while ago, it was something that was going on then too. And a lot of the great sages of that generation were speaking about it and sort of crying out. Right? So, you know, the Ramak was considered to be sort of the preeminent rabbi and disseminator of Kabbalic teachings to his students. And yet he came out and he said that people are making a mistake. There are people that don't ground themselves properly in scripture and in the Talmud before they start entering the discipline of trying to figure out what the Kabbalah is. And the Vilna Gaon says something similar. It says someone who wishes to engage in that which is above his level, that is, he wants to study Kabbalah without fulfilling and studying the laws, will not succeed. For it's only possible to approach the secrets of Torah through the revealed aspects. So this was considered to be sort of a mainstream, what we call litvish, a mainstream non-Hasidic approach in his time. And then it's just another source in the Talmud again. It says, one may not teach the hidden aspects of the Torah unless his student is a wise individual who can intuit what he's being taught. Right? So this again goes back to that discussion of the various elements of Torah that one has to explain either in private or only to select individuals who really have amassed a certain grounding in Torah understanding and Talmudic understanding. So one of the prerequisites, as we're going to see in the next source described by the Ramban, is that somebody has to have a reliable mentor to be able to guide them through it. Right? When we talk about a master, a Rav, which literally means master, it is somebody who's supposed to guide someone through a real understanding of what Kabbalah is. So it says, I hereby enter the reader into a covenant, this is what we saw before, whereby he undertakes not to philosophize and hypothesize about anything I write that has to do with the secrets of the Torah. Let it be known that nothing of this sort can be fathomed without a received oral tradition from a wise mentor. Advancing logical explanations in these matters is pure foolishness and is harmful and counterproductive. For someone who cannot avail himself of such a tradition, he should restrict himself to those parts of my commentary that deal with revealed aspects of the Torah, taking from them the constructive ethical lessons of our holy sages. Do not seek out what is greater than you. Do not investigate that which is more powerful than you. Do not attempt to know that which we are presently in. Rav Shimon bar Yochai received divine inspiration which enabled him to create a systematic exposition of the concepts of Kabbalah. Whoops, sorry, I went the wrong way. Let's start that sentence again. Right? Don't seek out what that's greater. At what is greater than you. Do not investigate that which is more powerful than you. Don't attempt to know that which is far from you. Do not ask about that which is hidden from you. Meditate upon what you have been taught, for you have no business with the hidden matters.
Who is this?
The Ramban, Nachmanides. Now remember, this is the same Nachmanides that wrote in his commentary on the Torah elements of Kabbalah. But he cautions the reader that the reader has to know when to pull back and when not to try to understand what it is that he's written, because if you try to just use logic, if you feel that you're intelligent enough to figure it out, that's not going to work. Because things were packaged in such a way that they were not meant to be understood by people without a master who can explain what the metaphors are. It's like trying to decipher codes without getting the key. Any questions? So far? Yeah?
So whose knowledge is more enough today to discuss these
things? Well, there are people who are Kabbalists. Rabbi Yaakov Hillel is a big name in Kabbalah. You know, the rabbi who was killed recently has two brothers who are also considered to be tremendous in terms of Kabbalah. Rabbi Yitzchak David Abuchatzera lives in Nahariya. He's also someone that my wife and I had a chance to go and try to visit to get blessings from.
Those are the grandsons or great-grandsons?
Those are the grandsons of the Baba Sali.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, there are personalities that are known about who are considered to be on the level of really having a very strong understanding of Kabbalah. Okay, so we say that the tradition continues to exist, but again, it's not necessarily accessible to everybody. People have to earn the privilege of being able to study it.
So what you're saying, Kabbalah is that fourth level that you mentioned, the knowledge of
the Sod. Right, of the secrets. Okay. So, yeah.
In Eli Wiesel's memoirs, I think he had like a group of people, and some of them died also when they got too deeply into Kabbalah. Is that something that happens when people just go into, like, if Rabbi Kiva was the only one who came out of that? Is there like restrictions? I mean, we're supposed to keep ourselves from, you know, keep ourselves healthy, and we're supposed to keep ourselves from, you know.
Right. So
we're supposed to put ourselves in harm's way.
Right.
So
that is the message that the Talmud is trying to deliver.
Yeah.
Right. That it's a very dangerous. It's very dangerous to start to delve into things that are so deep. I'm not familiar with the memoirs. I've read works by Elie Wiesel, but I'm not familiar about the. Could be, but
he said the Holocaust actually he felt saved his life. He was delving too deeply.
Okay, but what I can say is that today what we find is that there are a lot of people and a lot of groups that teach Kabbalah, and a lot of discussions as to what that Kabbalah is. So for some, what they're teaching is completely legitimate. But they're teaching things that they feel are relatively easy to access. So, you know, for example, there are a lot of Chabad rabbis that teach Kabbalah classes, and they have a tradition whereby they have been taught what it is that they're supposed to understand and also what it is that they're supposed to share with the masses. So there are people in that category. Unfortunately, what we find is that there are people that also teach Kabbalah that have never really been schooled by a master and who just have turned it into an industry. So I happen to have with me a pretty lengthy report that was published by a group in Los Angeles, particularly speaking about the Kabbalah Center, which is headed by or was founded by someone by the name of Philip S. Berg. And the organization that published the report is a task force on cults and missionaries. And what he explains is that Kabbalah was something that the Kabbalah Center professes to be teaching. Very often, what's different about the Kabbalah that's being taught at the Kabbalah Center is that it's taught with absolutely no prerequisites whatsoever. So it can be taught to people who are Jewish or not Jewish. You have to make zero commitment to anything. You don't have to take on any mitzvot. You don't have to have any prerequisite study of any sort. You can just come in and get involved. And for people that follow popular culture, we find that there are a lot of big personalities that have actually gotten very involved and donated millions and millions of dollars to the Kabbalah Center. The report here actually lists different financial statements that were taken from the IRS of assets, etc. We're talking about an industry that's worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars. There are books that are published. I remember when I was in Toronto, I used to have a Dorier salesman come and visit me at least once a year to try to sell me a book called Kabbalah for the Layman. That was one of Philip S. Berg's books. And it's something that took a lot, you know, really picked up a lot of steam when Madonna got involved. And it's something that, from a traditional religious perspective, is sort of anathema to what Judaism is supposed to be about and the Jewish approach to Torah study and Kabbalah study in particular. So I know that there are, you know, groups and organizations, and more of them, I think, year after year, that profess to be teaching Kabbalah that don't necessarily have their own grounding in the Torah and the Talmud and the tradition, nor have they had the access to a real master who could really teach them Kabbalah in a systematic way that would allow them to make sense of everything that they're learning. So there are bits and pieces that have become popular that people can talk about and people can throw out terminology. I've been in lots of presentations where I hear terminology thrown out, you know, the 10 spheres, and people will start talking about what they are and what they're called and what they do. But as you try to drill down and figure out where they're really coming from, they don't necessarily have all that much of an understanding of what it is that they're referring to, nor do they have an understanding of what it is they hope to accomplish through the teaching. When people come and they study Talmud, for example, so it's clear that they're in pursuit of a higher ethical standard for themselves, that they want to have a clear understanding of how it is to conduct their business affairs according to a Torah perspective. They want to have an understanding of how it is that they should conduct their social affairs. Right? There's virtually no topic that the Torah wouldn't inform in some way. One interesting, I guess, element of Judaism is Judaism acknowledges the physical world that we live in as a reality. Meaning that even though there are aspirations to spirituality, and we're all supposed to aspire to be spiritual, we acknowledge that we're very grounded and we're very, very physical. And therefore, when we take the Torah as an instruction book, it deals with things that we would consider to be completely mundane. But it acknowledges a reality that we were created as a synthesis of a spiritual element, which we call our soul, and a very physical body. So we have to live within a physical world, and therefore the Torah is going to inform us on how to do that. For people that try to jump and ignore the physical reality of us as human beings and aspire only to spiritual, and one of the methods that they think they can do that through is through Kabbalah, we say that that's not a Jewish approach. All the great Kabbalists that we know also wrote commentaries on the more accessible elements of the Torah, right? So they were well versed for sure in Tanakh, right? In the, you know, the Bible. And they had complete erudition in the Talmud, and they were able to speak about any Jewish matter of any sort. The Kabbalah was something that they then started delving in eventually. There are today lots of works and books where that people can access to give you a sense of what sorts of things are considered to be Kabbalah. There was actually an author, a rabbi who died also at a very, very young age. His name was Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. And he wrote a whole number of works that you can buy on Amazon, right? They have the Aryeh Kaplan Reader, etc. So some of his works actually are sort of at the threshold of what would be considered Kabbalistic. Talks about meditation and what people are supposed to concentrate in meditation. So when it comes to works like his, again, he felt that he wanted to try to stimulate Jewish conversation almost and to try to teach people as much as he felt that they could know without having that level of grounding. But even he writes that the ideal is for somebody to get a good basis in understanding what are the commandments, what's the revealed word of the Torah before we start trying to figure out everything that goes above and beyond. Any questions on that so far?
Yeah, so what exactly are the requirements for somebody to study Kabbalah specifically? They have to be Jewish, they have to be 40. What are the requirements? Because I have both older people and younger people that I know that are friends of mine, you know, that follow this kind of stuff with the Kabbalah industry. Most of them are Jewish. A couple people are, you know, not Jewish. But if I'm having a discussion, like what what are the requirements? Like, what? I definitely don't know what's going on. I don't feel like I'm qualified to learn it. But in general, like for person A, what are the requirements?
So usually the basic requirements have to do with making sure that you have a very, very solid grounding in understanding what's known as the reveal word, meaning understanding what's in the Torah itself, the five books, and in the Talmud. So the Talmud was oral tradition that was eventually put down as case law, right, or as anecdotes, like I said before, this time capsule. Somebody that's really mastered that and has a good grounding and understanding of that, as well as the halacha, can then start to approach Kabbalah. And the reason that that is as follows. This is going to sound Kabbalistic. Could be it is. But within the commandments, there's an idea that there are 613 commandments. The commandments can be divided into two categories. Commandments that we call positive commandments, which means requirements that we are supposed to do, and then negative commandments, which are restrictions, things we are not supposed to do. So there's an idea that within the commandments, there are 248 commandments, which somehow are supposed to correspond to all the various limbs and organs and sinews within a human body, and that every time a person performs a commandment, it's supposed to provide some kind of a corrective measure to the individual in a spiritual sense. The 365 commandments correspond to the cycle of the sun, which is sort of the backdrop upon which we live to some extent. So there's all sorts of different explanations. Also, 365 is corresponding to some of the various, you know, tendons, ligaments, etc. Right? There's a whole discussion of that also. But the idea is that if somebody wants to perfect their character, those commandments are supposed to be the tool that we use to perfect ourselves. So every time someone does something positive, it's regarded as a commandment, so then they develop within themselves some element of perfection. The Ramchal actually explains this really well in a work called Derech Hashem, The Way of God, which is sort of his very basic book that should be accessible to people. It's a little bit dense, right? You have to spend a lot of time really thinking through what he's talking about. But he explains that ultimately we're supposed to strive to attain perfection. Once we feel that we've obtained some level of perfection, then we can start talking about really trying to relate to God. And that's where Kabbalah would come in. So that's the real prerequisite. People talk about having to be 40, having to have kids. There's all sorts of different measures that people will use to tell you when someone might be ready, but I think that universally people would acknowledge that you have to have a good grounding in Torah beforehand.
I also heard that some of the people that teach this, like, alternative, I don't know if it's called, like, alternative Kabbalah, they're separated, like, you don't have to believe in God, or there is no God, you know, is that possible that they would teach this?
So again, you know, I can't speak for every group, right? I don't necessarily know. It would surprise me that they would go that far. What they do say, which is clear, is the Kabbalah Center has made it very clear, it's even very public, that they don't require any, the keeping of any commandments whatsoever, right? People don't have to, you know, Madonna was never told she has to convert to Judaism to be able to be their greatest adherent in Los Angeles. That was never a prerequisite. Yeah.
So, Rabbi, I have some thoughts, but maybe they're too long to. I could mention them or ask you afterwards.
If you think they would contribute, you can feel free, and then.
So I just.
And we can continue offline if it gets to be too long.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay. You can stop me if I get carried away.
Okay.
So, you know, I understand what you're saying about the Kabbalah centers, which I'm not that thrilled about either. What little I know about it. But on the other hand, I feel like I have a concern about this, about the study of Kabbalah, about the restrictions of the study of Kabbalah. Because we have things like Ramchal, who was ostracized by the Jewish community. Why? For studying Kabbalah, because the rabbis at the time thought that this was something that shouldn't be done, correct? So they ostracized him.
Okay, so I'll clarify. Not for studying Kabbalah, but for putting it into writing. And okay. for making it accessible. Once you have a book written, the book can fall into any hands.
See, but that's a big concern of mine, because to me, you know, the one thing that I get out of modern Judaism, I say modern after the fall of the Second Temple, and so on, that the thing is that education is above all. I mean, other than, you know, actually the mitzvot, and, you know, but it's very high. I mean, in other words, and so something that restricts it, it is very concerning, because if you look through history, you see that the groups that have restricted, and it hasn't been Jews as far as I've known, except for, as you talked taught us about Kabbalah, the groups that restrict learning are those that want to stay in power. And basically, you know, the priests, the Catholics, a lot of Christianity has done that, obviously Islam is doing that. I mean, it's a way of saying that you can't understand this, so you need us to understand it. And that's a big concern of mine.
Okay, good. It's a good question. I think the difference between groups where, you know, knowledge becomes power because it's restricted only to a few and they try to keep the masses uneducated, I think the difference is that within Judaism, the attempt is to educate everybody. In other words, everybody is really encouraged to study as much as possible. The more one studies, the more they could then become, you know, the potential recipient of all of this oral transmission. But it's got to come with a framework. In other words, we push education for sure. You know, if you look at the yeshiva world, so to speak, today, there are thousands and thousands of people that study, you know, 12, 13 hours a day, who aren't necessarily touching Kabbalah, but there's so much to study and there's so much to learn and they're involved with it all the time. And at a certain point, they do start entering into the study of Kabbalah once they feel that they're grounded. So it's not like it's a club where they, you know, they limit participation based on wanting to keep it in the hands of only a small few. It's that people have to work their way up the ladder. In education, in a secular perspective, we actually work the same way. We just use different terminology, right? We don't introduce quantum physics necessarily to a fifth grader.
Right, and that's exactly the analogy I was thinking. But the thing that I guess what strikes me is when we got, you know, Rambam saying that you must not study this unless you have these requirements because you won't understand it, and talk about people going mad, you know, great scholars of Judaism going mad for seeing this, that's a concern. And part of it is, you know, my feeling about Jewish tradition, which is a tradition not grounded in the kind of Talmudic education that I wish I had, but that, you know, that nothing is beyond human grasp, and that, you know, I mean, in other words, I wouldn't teach someone calculus before algebra or algebra before, you know, multiplication. But if someone wants to open up an algebra book, and in fact, in Judaism, there are some of these stories are of people who did fantastic things through divine inspiration. They understood things that we thought they couldn't. And I wouldn't want to put these hard restrictions on people. And also, in my background, I've gone through studies where I've been told many times, you don't have the background for this. That was just wrong. It was a combination of people trying to protect their area of expertise from encroachment, and sometimes just foolishness.
Right. So I guess two more comments maybe in response. The first one is, you have to remember, the same Ramban that cautioned the reader put it in writing.
Right.
In other words, it's there, right? That's just one comment. The other comment is as follows. I think one of the I guess the perspective that's a little bit different when it comes to Kabbalah is that we look at Kabbalah as being a study or a science or an area of knowledge that exists, that was revealed and needs to be passed down from generation to generation. In other words, just like the Ramban said, it's not about your level of intelligence and, you know, your analytical reasoning and the other skills that one would normally use to try to decipher and figure things out. It's that there is sort of this, you know, this existent area of knowledge that you want to be able to access. So the only way to get it is to go to somebody who has it, because it's so different than anything that you would find in the normal course of study of anything else, right? It's God, and it's the way God runs the world, and it's sort of beyond. So I hear the concern in it, for sure. It's just very hard to understand the way around it, right? In other words, it's something that you would really have to be able to have access to in order to really feel that you have it. And so, therefore, you have to go to somebody that has access to it, or has it, and they will only give it to you if they feel you're worthy of it, right? Being worthy of it is something that we have a pretty democratic approach to. In other words, anybody that really wants to access it can buckle down and start studying. Rabbi Akiva himself, right, the one who survived, says he didn't start studying until he was 40. Right? And only then did he start really delving into things. And eventually he reached a level that he could walk into the whole thing and come out unscathed.
How old was he?
How old was he at that point?
How old was he when he
Probably somewhere around 60, something, I would guess, when this episode took place.
He was one of the rabbis that was murdered, right?
Yes.
Eventually, yeah.
Yes.
By the Romans. Yeah.
I was interested in this popular topic I brought for all this Kabbalah in that industry. What purpose of this $1 million industry?
How is it so successful? In other words, who are they preaching to? Who are they involving?
What purpose, yes.
Lots of people. Listen, it happens to be that people out there are looking for meaning in life very often. Especially people that feel that they reached success and thought that when they got there, everything would be perfect. And they realize that things aren't perfect yet. You have to understand, Kabbalah is touted as Jewish mysticism. So everybody would like to be able to have access to some kind of mystic power in some way and do all sorts of things. And there are promises of healing. I have a cousin, right, who I mentioned before, who was very involved. And when my grandfather was literally dying, she came into his room and she took a copy of the Zohar and she started running his finger across the pages because she was told that this would heal him. Didn't. But she really bought into this idea. And then they said to her, well, you know, it could be that it would have worked, but you're not worthy enough because you haven't given us enough money because you have to give more charity. So then she would give more charity and then try again and didn't work again. And so she would have to give more charity. It was a whole system where people really, really believe, you know, people do very much believe that they're going to have access to something very spiritual that'll change their lives for the good.
This is the first time that I was going to say that somebody took the concept of Judaism, which are terrific concepts, and simplified them and made them available to the masses. I think it happened around 70 CD.
What I was going to say was Scientology is so popular. So this is the Jewish product of Scientology type thing?
Well, no, there are people...
Right,
so there are people that make a comparison. Yeah. You know, again, the cult, the you know, task force for cult missionaries, right? So there are lots of links to all sorts of other cults that exist. And groups that are...
Scientology works the same concept.
Right.
You keep more money, you're more powerful, we'll give you more knowledge, go to another level, and
right.
we'll take you up.
Right. That's right.
And has the movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
It's now Scientology related to Christianity? I rather it was just like aliens and things.
You have to come back for the Scientology class.
And that one would be $10 more.